Buddhist Summer School, Monday, 17th August, 1987. Yesterday, we considered the ideal of social morality as taught by Brahmanical India and confirmed very succinctly by the Buddha. It bespeaks a kindly, loving relationship between all members of a nation. But whilst ideals, inspiring and beautiful though they be, and manifested in everyday life by the very few who are gifted with the capacity and skill to live up to them, how many people living the worldly life can actually live up to them? The Kakachupama Sutta, that's number 21 in the Majjhima, is instructive here. At one time, when the Lord was staying in the Jeta Grove in Anathapindika's monastery, the venerable Moliya Phaguna lived too closely associated with the nuns. Don't make a mistake about this. That is, he exhorted them until late in the evening for too long a time, speaking more than 5 or 6 sentences at a stretch, and he spoke in fun of serious offences. Ruthullapati Pakhonaka. This was conveyed to the Lord, who summoned Moliya Phaguna. The Lord asked him if this report was true. And was it also true that if some monk, face to face with him, spoke in dispraise of the nuns, he was angry and displeased and made a legal question of it? Was it true that if some monk, face to face with the nuns, spoke in dispraise of him, then the nuns, angry and displeased, made a legal question? Was it true, as it was said, that he, Phaguna, was living closely associated with the nuns thus? Phaguna confessed, "Yes, Lord." Thereupon, the exalted one pointed out, "But this is not suitable in you, Phaguna." Note the use of the word suitable. It is a mild word meaning appropriate or fitting, the done thing. It is not suitable, Phaguna, that you should live too closely associated with nuns. Wherefore, Phaguna, even if anyone face to face with you should speak dispraise of the nuns, even so should you get rid of those which are worldly desires, worldly thoughts, and you should train yourself thus: neither will my mind become perverted, nor will I utter an evil speech, but kindly and compassionate will I dwell with a mind of friendliness and void of hatred. Even if anyone in your presence should give a blow with the hand to these nuns, or with a clod of earth, or a stick, or a weapon, even then, Phaguna, you must train yourself thus: neither will my mind become perverted, nor will I utter an evil speech, but kindly and compassionate will I dwell with a mind of friendliness and void of hatred." After saying this to Phaguna, The Buddha says a few things to the monks present and proceeds to tell them the story of Vedahika, a lady householder living in Savatthi, who had a reputation for being gentle, meek, and tranquil. She had a woman servant named Kali, who perhaps had a doubting and inquiring turn of mind. Kali wondered whether her mistress had an inward ill temper, but did not show it because she, Kali, was a careful worker. So she decided to test her. She got up late next morning. Then Vedahika said, "Well now, Kali?" Who replied, "What is it, mistress?" "Now, why did you get up late today?" "That's nothing, mistress." "That's nothing indeed, bad servant. You got up late today." Angry and displeased, she frowned. Kali tested her further by getting up later next day. Vedahika spoke to Kali as on the previous day, but this time, angry and displeased, she spoke a word of displeasure. Kali tested her further and got up later still next morning. This time, the stock conversation ended up with the mistress seizing the pin of a dough bolt, and cracking Kali's head with it. Then the broken-headed Kali, streaming with blood, went out saying to the neighbors, "See, sirs, the deed of the gentle one, the meek one, the tranquil one." Thus the lady householder Vedahika acquired an evil reputation of being violent, not meek, not tranquil. The Lord then went on to say to the assembled monks, "Even so, some monk here is very gentle, meek, tranquil, as long as disagreeable ways of speech do not assail him. But when disagreeable ways of speech do assail him, it is then that he is required to be gentle, meek, tranquil." Whatever monk respecting, revering, honoring Dhamma comes to be easy to speak to is always suave, gentle and polite, blandly urbane. It's very interesting to note how he stresses urbane ways and speech. You get it in various suttas. Monks, there are five ways of speaking at a right or a wrong time: truly or falsely, gently or harshly, connected or not connected with the goal, with a friendly or hating mind. When you speak to others or when others speak to you, in any of those ways, you must train yourselves thus: neither will our minds become perverted, nor shall we utter an evil speech, but kindly and compassionate will we dwell, with a mind of friendliness, void of hatred, and beginning with him or them, as the case may be, we will dwell suffusing the whole world with a mind of friendliness that is far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable, without enmity, without malevolence. That is how you must train yourselves, monks. Monks, even if low-down thieves were to carve you limb from limb with a double-handled saw, Yet even then, whoever sets his mind at enmity, he for this reason is not a doer of my teaching. Herein, monks, you should train yourselves thus. Neither will our minds become perverted, nor will we utter an evil speech, but kindly and compassionate will we dwell with a mind of friendliness that is far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable, without enmity, without malevolence. This is how you must train yourselves. If you, monks, were to attend repeatedly to this exhortation on the parable of the saw, would you see any way of speech, subtle or gross, that you could not endure? No, Lord. Wherefore, monks, consider repeatedly this exhortation on the parable of the saw. For a long time, it will be for your welfare and happiness. And also, something which is not mentioned in the sutta, the psychical atmosphere of the region undergoes a change. When one sits in meditation, the Brahma Viharas, and suffuses the world, starting with some particular person, suffuses the world with metta, karuna, mudita, and upekha, he alters the psychical condition of his whole environment. It is noteworthy that the Buddha must have regarded speech as a matter of great importance, considering the amount he says on this topic. He does the same in the Brahmajala Sutta, when he presents what he calls the minor details of mere morality. If anybody can fulfill all these so-called minor details of mere morality, he would be a super saint. What he says on the moralities of abstention from killing, theft, and unchastity occupies only 15 lines of print. The subject of speech occupies 27 lines in the Brahmajala Sutta. This is to be expected. Consider for even a few moments how occupied man is with talking. Either his audible speech or his inaudible chatter, which he calls thinking. To both of which, I, in the early days of my youth, personally plead guilty. If elsewhere in the cosmos there are beings gifted with supernormal powers of hearing, and if some of them cared to turn their attention to us on earth, I am sure they would remark with no small amusement and with very kindly concern for our health, "My word, do those darlings ever spare their tongues?" Of course they would say it in English, for English is the universal language. Surely then, considering what has been taught regarding speech, not only by the Buddha, but also by all the true spiritual teachers of the world, it behoves all who are seriously trying to live the religious life to give our faculty of speech a good holiday, permanent where necessary. We can start by examining what proportion of our speech is true and wise, kind and helpful, and productive of harmony. The end of the Kakachupama Sutta sounds the note of the Buddha's symphony of silence. I call it symphony of silence because if any one of us can realize the state the enlightened one spoke of, he shall have realized the transcendent silence. It is sometimes said that the Buddha's teaching is mainly presented in negative terms, that it is coldly intellectual, that the emphasis is on abstaining from evil, that there is no positive affirmation of love. I challenge each and every single critic of the true religious teachers of the world, past and present, to present his credentials, to assess the value of a priceless pearl. You need a skilled, experienced old jeweler. So too, he who would evaluate a perfected holy one must needs have experienced at least a touch of transcendence. Regarding negative terms, we all know that famous saying in the Dhammapada, "Never in this world can hatred be stilled by hatred. It will be stilled by non-hatred." One reason why everyone is capable of hatred is that the psychophysical organism of man has evolved through several animal stages and has inherited constitutionally the characteristics of animals like the reptiles. All of us, without exception, have the reptilian complex surrounding the brainstem. This, which is something of a crocodile in us, serves as the apparatus through which violence, aggression, hate can function in our lives. So what chance is there for love to be pure, unsullied love, the love that transmutes and heals, as long as the psyche is a source of poison, the poison of jealousy, envy, possessiveness, anger, sensual greed and hatred? If any house is dusty or dirty, I cannot sprinkle a magical spray labeled cleanliness and delude myself that now the house is pure. I have to sweep away the dust, wash away the dirt, and then the house is clean, inviting, even fragrant. So too with the psyche. When the psyche is clean, love naturally blooms and the fountains of compassion freely flow spontaneously. When the mind is pure, the pool of wisdom is always full and overflows everlastingly. Wisdom and love are two sides of the same coin, the ever-rich coin of truth. Truth, love, and wisdom uphold the transcendent creative process of our universe. Such is Dharma, such is Dharana. Their crown is Samadhi, the supreme togetherness, the unitary wholeness realized in Buddhahood. Those who are seriously concerned with yoga will comprehend this. You know, yoga is associated far too much with a keep fit physical system. That is the least important part of the whole story. The yamas and niyamas, then of course comes the asanas and pranayama, and then the pratyahara, which really means freedom from attachment and aversion. That's what pratyahara really means. And then we get the stage of dharana. Dharana from the root dhri, meaning to uphold. What is it that we uphold? We uphold the law according to which the whole universe is a cause, cosmos, an ordered whole. That is dharana. And then we have the stage of samadhi, which is an all-togetherness. Samadhi is too often translated merely as concentration. It is not just concentration. Concentration is a part of the practice by which we can pay attention carefully to what needs to be attended. The samadhi is the state where in consciousness you experience, you realize the unitary wholeness of the totality. The truly great spiritual teachers all realize this stage. You know, I use the term holistic consciousness for this state. The perfect insight of the Buddha used suggestive terms, used negative terms, because whilst we are still subhuman, we do know what greed, hate and delusion are. We do not know virtue and the spiritual values. Clean the house, therefore, in which we live, and we shall live healthily, wholly, the holy life. Let us listen again to the Buddha's words. But whilst listening to the words, let our consciousness, serene, still and silent, awaken fully like the light of a quenchless flame needing no fuel. Awaken to the transcendent reality to which the words point. The Exalted One said, "Monks, whatsoever grounds there be for good works undertaken with a view to renewed life, all of them are not worth 1/16th part of that goodwill which is the heart's release. Goodwill alone, which is the heart's release, shines and burns and flashes forth in surpassing them." And then he puts the same thing in verse. "Whoso doth make goodwill to grow boundless, and thereto sets his mind," I should think setting his mind means his mind is always in that state fixed. "Seeing the end of birth's substrate, in him the fetters are worn thin. If with a heart unsoiled one feels goodwill towards a single being, he is a good man just by that. Compassionate of heart to all, the Aryan worketh boundless weal. Who smiteth not, nor makes others slay, robs not, nor makes others to rob, sharing goodwill with all that lives, he hath no hate for anyone." Love cannot be love unless one is incapable of malice and hate, including the hate of evil and evil doing, and certainly hate of the evil doer. You can't heal the evil doer if there's any hate towards him. All the forces of hatred have to be understood and transmuted into energies of non-hatred, whereupon the transcendent energies of love, latent in our constitution, in pure mind, can function freely through the purified psyche. In fact, psyche is now at one with pure mind, with Buddha nature, latent previously, but now in full flower. Then indeed we can enter the four Brahma Viharas, and with unobstructed spiritual power suffuse each of the four quarters of the world with metta, karuna, mudita and upekha, four positive modes of expression of love. The word upekha literally means indifference, but it is not indifference as we use it in the ordinary way. The state of upekha is a state of imperturbability. And in that state of imperturbability, there can be no obstruction to the outflowing of metta, karuna and mudita. That's why it is so important and is included in the Buddha's fourfold classification of the modes of love. In the Mahasuddhasana Suttanta, which is a long discourse, that's why it's called Suttanta, the Buddha is supposed to tell Ananda the story of one of his own, that is Gotama's, past lives as King Sudassana. The king enters the chamber of the great complex. Note the symbolism of this state of the psyche. The great complex, the great confusion, the great contradiction, and cries out with intense emotion, "Stay here, O thoughts of lust, ill will and hatred. Thus far only, O thoughts of lust, ill will and hatred." And when the king Mahasuddhasana, the great king of glory, had put away all evil passion and all unrighteousness, he entered into and remained in the first jhana, a state of calm joy and ease, born of seclusion, full of reflection and of investigation. The king then enters into the deeper jhanas, which are actually more intense and clearer states of consciousness, right up to the fourth jhana, the state of purified self-possession and perfect equanimity, due to the complete emptying of the psyche of all obstructions to the transcendent enlightenment. Do not regard this as if they were rungs on a ladder. You climb up, you climb nowhere. Because in these transcendent modes of consciousness, everything happens in the absolute here now. It is not there or there, today or tomorrow. You function in the context of infinity and eternity, in that case. Whereas our normal context is the context of finitude and temporality, which is the mortal context. And this is the immortal context. And then the great king of glory went out of the chamber of the great complex and entered the golden chamber. The golden chamber. Does this remind you of the golden egg, the Hiranyagarbha, or golden womb of the Hindu teachings, the source of creation of the universe? And how does creation or even procreation take place except through the stirring by love of the primordial creative energy? In the Rig Vedic creative hymn, creation hymn, book 10, hymn 129, kama, love longing, is called the primal seed and germ of spirit. And in the Greek pantheon, Eros, one of the loveliest and earliest of the gods, is the source of the bestowal of immortality upon Psyche after she has gone through heavy tribulation and become purified. King Mahasudarsana, after entering the golden chamber, lets the mind pervade the four quarters of the world successively with a heart of loving kindness, compassion, sympathy, and equanimity, which is love devoid of attachment and partiality. Such is love grown far-reaching and great, free from the least trace of anger and ill will. When the young Brahman Subha requests the Buddha to show him how he could realize companionship with Brahma, the creative God, the Blessed One teaches him to abide with a mind of loving kindness, metta, suffusing each of the four world quarters in succession. And the Buddha adds, thus he stays whilst he suffuses the whole world above, below, across, on all sides with a mind of loving kindness, wide, extended, immeasurable, without enmity or ill will. With the liberation of the mind through metta, he will not stop at what is finite. It's a very significant statement. I haven't seen any sort of commentary or expansion of this. There's an enormous amount hidden in that statement. He will not stop at what is finite, because the finite is the mortal. The infinite is the immortal. The Chandogya Upanishad is most instructive on that score. The implication is that it reaches out into the infinite, which is the realization of union with Brahma. Again, it is taught, this comes from the Buddha Vamsa 2.158 and 160, be thou unequaled in loving kindness, so also do thou suffuse friend and foe with loving kindness. And then from the Sutta Nipata, the Metta Sutta, as a mother, even with her life, protects her child, her one and only child, so let one cultivate a loving heart without measure towards all living creatures. Radiate metta over the entire world. Cultivate boundless goodwill for the entire world, free from ill will or enmity. Which sane person can say then, the Buddha made no positive affirmations on love?